You're listening to the Reinvest Podcast, where each Tuesday we will show you how to reclaim, reconnect, and refocus your life by bringing you the top real estate professionals in the industry. We'll pull back the curtain so you can implement these tools and tactics to build generational wealth. Your hosts, Garrett Gatton and Seth Simonillo. Hey guys, thanks for joining us on episode 63 of the Reinvest Podcast. We are tickled that you joined us today. I thought long and hard about what kind of intro. I was thinking we need to do like a Mr. Rogers variation, you know, maybe where we have a little like train track.
It's a wonderful day in the neighborhood.
Yeah, that's right. We got a unique guest with us today who's tackling some real estate projects that most of us probably would not touch with a 10-foot pole. fellow Ohioan, Luke Henry with Henry Development Group. What's up, Luke? How are you doing, man?
What's up, guys? Excited to be here. Unique. I will take that with a positive connotation. I think you mean that. But yeah, looking forward to
it. It's open to interpretation.
That's fair.
So you're a real estate investor, entrepreneur in Marion, Ohio.
That's right.
And you guys focus now, you're diverting a lot of your attention into some downtown revitalization projects, which we'll get into here later in the episode. But before we get into all that, man, give us your background. Who are you? How'd you get into real estate? What makes you unique?
I am unique. And it's such a loaded question. I always tell people that I'm still trying to decide what I want to be when I grow up because I just have had such a history that started with like little businesses when I was in elementary school. I think I was just always destined to be an entrepreneur. I started mowing lawns then when I was in junior high, and that kind of turned into my first somewhat legitimate business. Well, I mean, yeah, it was very humble beginnings. I started with a mower that I bought at a garage sale and just started mowing a couple of lawns and then built that organically over time. And so I still own that business and we've grown it significantly. But along the way, I also went to pharmacy school just down the road in Ada, got a doctor of pharmacy degree at Ohio Northern, practiced for just 2 years.
Wow.
And then decided to go be an entrepreneur full time. I never ran the landscaping business full time. I'd always been in junior high, high school, college, or working a full time job. And so took that leap in 2009. Started buying real estate also when I was in college, bought my first home when I was 19 and started that part of the journey. And since then, have started like 10 businesses or so and still operating quite a few of those.
So let's go back to you became a pharmacist. And so what was the change? What made you decide, hey, I would rather jump into full-time into the landscaping business?
And walk away from 6 years worth of schooling.
Right. Yeah. It was just a matter of, I think my wife helped me make that determination. At the time, sort of looking back, it's really funny because we thought we were busy at the time, even though we had no kids and we both had just regular full-time jobs, you know, 40-ish hours a week. She was a teacher. I was a pharmacist. And then we had a handful of rental properties and I was running this landscaping business on the side. And at the time I only had like 6 employees or something like that. So it's still relatively small, but it was busy and it wasn't what our lives were going to be. And she said, hey, don't you think that maybe you should choose like either be a pharmacist and kind of go this, you know, white collar route or go be an entrepreneur and go for it full time.
What color is the collar of the entrepreneur?
Oh, it was blue collar, man. You know, I was still in the phase where I was still doing a lot of day-to-day work. I was doing all the selling. I was doing the office work. Wow. I would go plow snow all night. And, you know, I even did that in college. I would go plow snow all night and then come back. We had a 7 a.m. exam every Friday.
Wow.
In pharmacy school. And I would come like roaring into my plow truck, park it and go in and go take an exam and then either go back to plowing or maybe crash a little bit. So,
wow.
Yeah. So,
so she kind of said, hey, you probably need to choose one or the other.
Yeah. Yeah. And so really I was like, well, obviously I went to school for 6 years, I spent an obscene amount of money on this doctorate level degree. And so clearly that's what I should do. And so I found someone that would buy my little landscaping business. They were going to buy all the equipment, the accounts, and we were putting the wheels in motion on that. And I just, I've been just thinking about it, praying about it, talking to my wife about it, and got to the point where I just had this revelation that I could always go back to being a pharmacist. Mm. But I've built this little business and really love just the opportunities that I see, the ability to lead people, make an impact, and serve people well in this industry. And I'm going to go give it a go. And if it doesn't work out, then, you know, I'll hang it up with no regrets and go back to being a pharmacist. Wow. And so that's what I did.
Wow. Wow. And you probably saw the scalability of owning your own business a little bit more maybe than being a pharmacist, or...
Potentially so. I don't know that I was that advanced or that smart at the time, honestly. I just thought that there was some opportunity, and yeah. I just felt like, man, I've been doing this at that point for 10, 12 years, and I was like, I just feel like I'm maybe at the tipping point where, especially if I put like all my effort towards this, I could really blow it up and make it something better.
That's really interesting. We were just talking today about the podcast, that 10-year time frame.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many other people we meet and other people we listen to on podcasts, and they're just like, it takes 10 years to really build a business. Mm. And it takes 10 years for you to really feel the effects of those 9 years of grinding,
yes,
you know, to really compound and to really start some snowballing, which it's discouraging to hear that, because you obviously, everyone wants to move faster. Everyone wants to grow faster and be at the peak faster. But it's one of those weird laws you hear all the time. It just takes people that long to really get things moving.
Yeah. You've maybe heard the saying that people overestimate what they can accomplish in a year, but they underestimate what they could do in 5, 10 years or a lifetime of disciplined, focused effort.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what you're saying. And I've seen it play out for myself for sure.
I think what's interesting about your decision to pursue the landscaping and set aside the pharmaceutical stuff is that it was kind of a purpose related question, you know, like, what do I think I could find more purpose in? And I heard you say that you thought that you could impact more people through the landscaping. So why was that? Not everybody thinks that way. Sometimes we're just kind of fixated on like
dollars and cents.
Yeah, right. So for you, I mean, what is that purpose that maybe that now drives you, was there at the beginning that caused you to choose that?
Yeah. Well, I think that I only saw a glimpse of it at that time, but looking back and where we sit today, now we employ around 100 people, and it's something that I can look around and say, and that decision then allowed me to grow immensely as an individual, as I learned how to lead larger and larger teams, leading leaders. Mm-hmm. And it's really become a huge focus and really a part of our ethos. In fact, we go so far to say now that we're a leadership company that happens to do landscaping.
Wow. And
it's really been an opportunity for me to invest in our team and help them grow personally, help them grow professionally, not just on the technical skills. Yes, we want to do those things and execute with excellence, but even more so, how can they grow and how can I grow so that I'm not the lid to the organization as we continue to
multiply? Yeah, could you give us an example of how you're doing that for your employees? How are you helping your employees grow?
Well, we really doubled down about 5 years ago where I'll give you kind of the short version of the story, which is basically we just acquired another business and we had went on a real growth spurt. We had like doubled revenue in a year.
Wow.
And so we grew really quickly. We brought a lot of people in and our culture just started to kind of implode. Mm-hmm. And we weren't being intentional enough about it. I didn't like working there anymore, to be honest. It really got to the point where the tail was wagging the dog, I guess. You know, we had some toxic people that were really making things difficult and were causing dissension, gossip, just some things that we didn't want to have and that weren't fun. And I went away on a trip and I had this revelation basically that I was the problem, but I also was the solution. When I discovered podcasts for the first time, I think I was behind the ball coming to that, but really like binged on leadership podcasts and realized that this is the missing piece. This is the missing piece for me and for members of our team. And so I came back just passionate about the fact that we needed to learn leadership. And so I developed a curriculum, I guess you'd say. I mean, I use that loosely, but just different resources that I pulled together. And so I pulled together our office and leadership team, which is maybe 12 or 14 people at the time, and said, okay, we're going to do this thing. It's mandatory. It's paid. But for an hour every week, we're going to do a leadership study. I'm going to lead it. And the only deal is, you know, again, you get paid to be there, but everyone's got to engage. And this is going to be the piece that's really going to drive us into the future. And it has been. It's been really completely transformational to our team, our culture. It helped us kind of define clearly who we were, what we were about, how we were going to do the leadership part of the business.
Yeah.
It kind of self-selected some people you know, were just like, okay, this is not really what I want to be a part of anymore,
right.
Which were those individuals that were not good for
kind of the body rejecting the parasite, you
right,
know?
Yeah. And so it's been incredible. And then I've been able to see those lessons then translate and kind of ripple through the organization to our other like field staff, our leaders there. We've done some different trainings, but also just the day to day, you know, when that's your culture and that's the way that we're treating each other, it's very clear. We're respectful. We're high feedback. And it just has changed the way that we do business. And it's been really gratifying because we've even had lots of people who have, I'm going to say lots, but a handful of people that have left the organization and have went out of their way to come back and say, you know, man, what I learned while I was at ProScape just through leadership study and through what we were doing here, it really set me up for the next stage of my career. And it really made me better personally. It made me a better parent, a better spouse, a better friend. And, you know, there's no reward better than that.
Yeah. Right.
So it's been really meaningful.
You put your money where your mouth was. I mean, from a business perspective, you pull 12 to 14 of your leadership people in there for an hour a week and you pay them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's hundreds of dollars every week that you're investing in them because it was that important to you, which I think is awesome. So that, you know, that all happened prior to the downtown development stuff that you guys have since gone into.
That's right.
Okay. Yep. So in many ways, it set the foundation for you to tackle some other business ventures or projects that required the presence of leadership development, even though you didn't know the tactics of that yet.
Right. Yeah, really and truly. And then also allowed the landscaping business to function well without my constant presence and oversight because I was developing leaders that were truly empowered, truly had authority and room to make decisions and grow the business and do all of that. And so I could take my focus and my energy, which are very finite resources, to go and do this other work that I'm passionate about.
Wow. Well, we didn't plan to get into any of that related to leadership, but I'm glad that we did because
that's awesome.
It is the foundation. I think it's so vital. And when you talk about entrepreneurs, it's the kind of the curse and the blessing is the same. Quick ideas, fast moving, you know, high risk tolerance. But there's got to be some structure that allows each of those endeavors to succeed.
Well, and every entrepreneur would say, I want to grow a business. I want to build a business. But what you discovered is that unless I can set the business up to run without me or without my full attention, it's not really a business. It's just a job.
Right.
And because you were willing to look in the mirror and work on yourself and, you know, kind of develop some of those leadership skills and be able to train those and communicate it, it really sets you up for some other investing and entrepreneurial stuff that you wanted to do. So that's really cool.
Yeah, I'm so grateful that I was able to get to that realization and it really made a lot of the other things. You know, we can kind of retrace the dots backwards. We can't see them forwards, but we can see the dots coming together in the rear view mirror and say, wow, I learned that, which led to this, which led to this. And, you know, even some of the failures, you're like, well, that was a lesson that I took. And then I didn't repeat it. So
it forward,
it was a learning lesson.
So we talked about passion. Obviously, you have a passion for leadership and developing people. We alluded to this in the beginning of the episode, is you guys are doing some very niche real estate projects that would be over a lot of people's heads. So talk about some of the, what is the passion that's driving you guys to take on these downtown revitalization projects?
Well, I'll say first that they were also over my head, like way over my head. At first, it may be still. I'm still feel like I'm drinking from the fire hose some days. But the reason was rather simple, and that is that when I looked around our downtown, it was not something that I could be really proud of. Mm. And my wife and I had determined that we intended to raise our family in Marion, Ohio. And when we looked around in the downtown, the soul of the community literally built to be the place where people gathered, where they shopped, dined, and came together was not something that was suitable for any of that. Mm. Then we said, this has got to change. Someone has to do something. And I looked around and there was nobody else there. Really, you know,
no looking to do that.
It. Yeah. And maybe, and maybe that's overstated. There were some people doing some things, but we needed to do more quickly in order to really create the momentum that we needed. Because what we saw was, again, there was a few folks that would do maybe, you know, a building, or they would try to open a store or a restaurant, and there just wasn't the critical mass to bring the people.
Right.
And without the people, without the energy, without the momentum, then those things will quickly go away.
Yeah, that density is really important in the downtown, kind of that model. What was the first project that you guys took on that was really kind of the fruit of you deciding we're going to do something about
this? And talk about maybe too, what was the scope of work? What was the vision? And then how many buildings did you guys buy and all that stuff?
Yeah. So we started, you mentioned kind of the classic entrepreneur, you know, moving quickly, you know, high risk tolerance, just going for it. That's me. And so I linked up with a partner, and we saw, again, the opportunities. We saw the issues. We saw that one little project here or there wasn't going to do it. And so our kind of main block that we focused on was one block of South Main Street that was 70% vacant. There was very little going on. There's a couple of attorney offices, one little restaurant, tattoo parlor, secondhand clothing store, and some vacant buildings. And we said, this is it. This is where there needs to be community created. And so we quietly bought 8 buildings.
Now, why do you say quietly?
Well, because we didn't want to come in with a bunch of fanfare and start driving up prices.
Yeah.
You know, from speculators, the people that owned these buildings, many of them had owned them for a long time,
right,
were doing absolutely nothing with them. There was no vacant building legislation. There was nothing compelling them to sell them,
right, or do something
to do anything with it. Yeah. And so
how did you quietly buy them? Cause I mean, that's a very tactical and smart thing to do, because, you know, we see this all the time in real estate. You have, you know, maybe so-and-so inherited this from dad who owned this 40 years ago. They don't know what to do with it. Mm-hmm. And they hear something's happening in the downtown, and they have this unfounded sticker price. They slap on the building and say, well, now we want $300,000 for it. And unfortunately, it's working against them and then the community, because it's really not going to sell. So how'd you guys quietly buy 8 buildings?
Well, once we decided that was going to be the tactic, there was a couple of them that were for sale. Mm-hmm. And they were just vacant, had for sale signs in it. So those were easy enough. A couple others, my partner, Alex, he had heard kind of some rumblings that maybe this person would sell or this person would sell. And then candidly, we just went around to some other, basically everyone that owned buildings on the block, and reached out to them and just said, hey, would you be interested in selling your building? And again, just kind of kept everything quiet, didn't announce any kind of plans or whatever, and just were able to assemble a block of buildings on this block.
Yeah. What was the time frame for kind of most of those acquisitions from the time you bought your first one?
Probably like 4 to 6 months, something okay. like that. So, I mean, wow. it was fairly.
So, you got your inventory.
So, the conversation was, honey, what do you want to do this quarter? Let's buy thousands of square foot of vacant downtown buildings that need remodeled. And you executed.
That
Good
was
job.
About how the conversation.
Obviously, you said you've been married for 18 years, so your marriage didn't end at that point.
It did not. No, every time I have a conversation, you know, people basically get to this point like, you're really crazy. You're certifiably crazy. And I always have to say, yes, I am. And my wife has stuck by me through all of this and has been along for the ride. And there's been a lot of uncertainty and some dark days. And there's been plenty of those moments where I've been like, oh, what did I do?
Yeah.
I kind of got myself in over my head here and
got to make it work,
complain. And, she supports me and says, you've done it before, you can do it again. And so we figured out.
Wow. That's so, awesome. That first project, you know, we were off camera and you had mentioned, that it was hard to get business owners, existing or startups, to get sold on the idea of come locate your business here in these buildings. So you guys had to create some of your own inventory, to bring eyes into the downtown and actually feel excited about it. So what was the first renovation project? What was the first business that you guys put on your back and said, we're going to do this?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think it has to start with the vision, and the vision has to be well thought, and it's got to be viable and it's got to be compelling. And so we invested some money to have a group do some 3D renders of what we expected the block to look like and really try to paint a clear picture to people of what this was going to be. Because if we just make this announcement and people drive down the block, maybe they haven't been there for many years, and they look around, they're like, wow, I'm not sure how that's going to happen. This right. does not look like the center of community here that everyone's going to gather. And so we created these renders and then made sort of our grand announcement that this is what we've been working on. This is what's coming. It's Main Street reimagined. It's going to be the center of dining, entertainment, and shopping in downtown Marion. Mm. And so we started to make a list of kind of a curated concept of things that we thought were going
this
to be
ecosystem.
Vibrant, an ecosystem. Yep. So we tried to, for example, like create a date night experience. So we wanted to create something as quickly as we could that would include entertainment, place for drinks, place for food, place for dessert. And then also looking at what are things that bring traffic on a consistent basis. Mm-hmm. Hair salons were an answer to that. Coffee shops and different restaurant concepts, like all of those are really important to right. drive consistent traffic.
Yeah.
And then the retail would follow. And so that's really what we set out to do. And so we went to other communities where there were coffee shops, ice cream shops, hair salons, and those sorts of things, and tried to recruit those people to bring their concept to downtown Marion. They obliged us. They came and looked. We walked them through the buildings. We showed them the pretty pictures. We looked at how it could be laid out and just the vision that we had. And pretty much all of them ended the same, which was, hey, we love the passion. We love the vision.
Keep us posted.
Yeah, keep us posted. Right now it's too early, but maybe someday.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were like, well, we've committed to this. We bought these 8 buildings and we're now making payments on these. And so we need to figure out how to overcome this challenge. How are we going to make it successful? Mm-hmm. And we decided, well, we'll just start some businesses ourselves and get this going. And so we started an ice cream shop, a wedding venue, a smaller events venue, and a hair salon, kind of a salon lofts type concept. And, we started all those on our own. Meanwhile, we started renovating some loft apartments to also drive the idea of living where you, you know, work, play, dine, and all of that. Mm-hmm. And these are kind of new concepts. There's some other living places, but not necessarily on that block. And so just started getting to work on that.
So what was the, because I mean, a lot of those old buildings, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 stories. I don't know. What's the average of how many stories would be in the downtown of Marion?
Most of them on this block. This is like the oldest block in Marion. So these are mid to late 1800s buildings. Wow. And so a lot of those are not as big. So they're two to three stories. Yeah, two to three.
So from a zoning perspective, obviously you guys were, they worked with you then to be able to do some of the loft apartments and stuff.
Yeah, zoning, not so much of an issue. That was at our city level. We do not have a local building department in Marion. And so all of our architectural and engineering plans actually have to go to the state for plan review and then go through the inspection process of that. Very time consuming, very expensive, and a steep learning curve on commercial codes, bringing things up to commercial code. And we found out quickly is commercial code is not written for old buildings. It's written for new buildings.
Right,
and so while there are some exemptions and exceptions made through what's called Chapter 34 of the code that allow things to be kind of, quote, grandfathered in, there's still a lot to work around as you're changing and reimagining these types of uses.
Well, because, I mean, yeah, you're going to, you know, you work with your design team, your architect, you submit those plans to the state, and then the state says, you can't do X, Y, Z, and the way that it was probably designed was intentional on purpose, either for cost or amenities that you could offer. So were some of those things, like, was the goal to have these pencil from a cash flow perspective? Or did you know that you might, quote unquote, lose money on the first few for the hope that, you would create the density that then help kind of push things over the edge?
Right. The goal was always that they would make money. Don't always meet our goals, right? But at least we set out with that goal. And I've often said, like, kind of the concept that may transfer to other types of developers is we were basically creating the golf course. And so on a golf course, like, oftentimes they're not super profitable, but oftentimes what happens is that creates an area that is highly desirable for residential around it. And so, you know, if a developer does a golf course and some housing, like, they're probably going to make more on the housing around the golf course. So we had to create the golf course first, which was the place where people wanted to go. And then it could be also the place where people wanted to live.
Right. That's really interesting.
That is interesting. So have you faced other opposition maybe within the community about the project, or what's been the reception from the people that actually live there?
It's been generally good. I mean, it started as a lot of excitement, people very excited to see something really significant happen in the downtown. It was really interesting to hear from different generations of people, especially older generations that grew up going to the downtown. You know, we'd hear all these stories about, we would always go to such and such restaurant after church on Sundays, or we'd always go this place on Friday nights, or I got my first suit downtown, or I used to get our school clothes, or, you know, this other, whatever special memory they had of going downtown. And then really, younger folks as well, it's kind of become cool again, to have, like, new urbanism and in small downtowns that are really coming back in vogue, where there was a period of time, especially in the 70s, 80s, 90s, that nobody went downtown. That wasn't cool. You went to the shopping mall, you went to the suburban sprawl, and that was how people did commerce. Yeah. And so you know, different people, but generally very good reception. Now, we've faced our fair share of critics, and there's also this phenomenon that I didn't expect, and that is that when you first start out and you're trying to do something new and you're really bootstrapping it, you have a lot of people cheering for you from the sidelines, and everyone's really excited. And then there comes a point that you eclipse what they think is like a reasonable level of success, or maybe their level of standard of living or something. And if they perceive, it doesn't have to be true, but when they perceive that you cross that threshold, that now they kind of turn from a cheerleader to maybe not a hater, skeptic, but maybe not as adamant a supporter. And so we've had a little bit of that. And I think that we just have learned that criticism is the cost of leadership, and that when you're doing something new, there's going to be people that don't understand it, that they don't like the status quo being interrupted. Maybe they're preying on the way things are currently, which is not
right.
what we perceive to be good for the community. And so they don't want to disrupt that. And so there's just, there's a lot of dynamics that I didn't expect. You know, I just expected it to be, we're fixing up the downtown. Of course, everyone's going to be excited. They're going to be supportive.
Lighted area.
You know, come out and generally, yes. But you have to focus on the people that are still excited for it. And also just know deeply, passionately that we are doing the right thing. Like we are really on mission with this work and we want to make an impact positively in our community.
I think what's wild to me, because that dynamic that you described, I've heard other people who have been successful in whatever industry describe that same kind of, and really it's a human condition. And what's wild is even the people who were cheering you on when you kind of eclipsed their level of success, like they probably even would admit that they don't want to spend as much money to tackle that or to take the risk or aren't even interested in doing what you're doing.
Right.
So it's not even a reflection on them, but for some reason they're making it kind of about them in some weird way.
Feel threatened or whatever.
Yeah. But yeah, unfortunately that's across the board. So
let's jump into our smaller pockets.
Can I make a request?
Yeah. I want to hear the story.
Yeah. About your kids and your wife. So make that your smaller pocket segment. Okay.
We're choosing Sorry. Yeah. Just about that whole first
experience.
It was
just so good.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Let's do it.
Jumping into our smaller pockets. So this is a part of the show where you tell us about a deal that went wrong. What's your worst deal? What happened? What went wrong? And then what did you learn from it?
Okay, so many lessons we could unpack on this, but I'll start with the story. So basically, we, you know, you've been hearing this story, how we got going, and our first project, basically two first projects. So the first big project was our wedding venue. And we expected from the very beginning when we acquired these eight buildings, like this was going to be our flagship project. Yep. It was going to be our first major project. We believed that if we could do this well and bring people in every weekend for weddings, you know, wave after wave, they're going to see the downtown. They're going to see how it's improving. They're going to be impressed by this place. They're going to go tell their friends. And especially if they're from out of town, word will start to spread in other places that Marion, Ohio, there's some cool things going on there. And even if we couldn't control all the other factors and fix everything up at once, if we had this one place, it could really be something that caused an inflection.
Wedding venues are sexy right now. I mean, they're just the buzz. For whatever reason, people are willing to spend a lot of money on weddings. My wife and I look at each other. I think we had less than $3,000 into our wedding dress, everything. So not what's going on today.
Right.
But hey, you saw the vision. You saw that trend.
Yeah, we saw an opportunity, a trend for sure. And so we wanted that to be our first big project. So we got to work on that basically immediately. Now, it was a large project, so I had to go through all that architecture and engineering and all that process that we talked about. We had to appeal some things and jump through a bunch of extra hoops and work with the local fire official and all these things that I did not expect. We got a total education on that. Meanwhile, we bought a much smaller building, small project. It was a tattoo parlor, and we wanted to turn it into a bright, cheerful, colorful ice cream shop.
Mm.
And these are on the same block. There's two doors in between. And so we kind of worked on those simultaneously. We actually finished the ice cream shop fairly quickly. It was like a 90-day project. And so we got that done. We opened it in July of 2019. Yeah. It went quickly. And it was really like pretty heavily cosmetic. There wasn't a lot of the other structural and
the build
roof
out,
and
suppression,
you know,
systems
that we had in the other project. So we got that going. So we had an operating business on the block. We were running it. We had an operating partner there and he was doing a good job. People were coming. It was getting people downtown. They're starting to see the progress. So we felt like the wheels were slowly starting to turn. We get to working on the wedding venue. It went, of course, you've heard the saying, like, if you get a timeline and a budget, you should just double it, and that's probably going to get you pretty close. I'm sorry to say it was probably even more than double what we expected, but we got it done. We white-knuckled our way through, and we were so excited to open on February 29th, 2020. our wedding and event venue.
It's an auspicious date. Yeah.
So, and then we had 5 events there, and then COVID shut everything down. So,
the
smaller pockets piece comes from the fact that we made money by people gathering, and then people weren't allowed to gather anymore.
And just shy of a month later or whatever it was.
Yeah, we literally, we pushed, we postponed weddings, we canceled corporate events. Because
you probably had deposits from people that you had to return, right? That they couldn't facilitate, or what that look like? How many events got canceled?
Yeah, I don't know exact number that got canceled. Most postponed, and it was just, I think in that time in history, there was a pretty high level of cooperation and everyone just trying to kind of figure things out. And people were excited for this project. They were really excited to have their event there. And so we were able to work with people. And honestly, we went to them and we said, look, we want you to have your event here. We believe it's going to happen one day. If we can keep from having to give your deposit back, that'd be really good because, see, we don't have it because we spent it on finishing this place.
What had happened was.
Right. And people were really generally pretty understanding. Wow. And so, good.
Well, it's not like they were going to go anywhere else and get married either. So it's like.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, all the weddings still happened. They just got postponed. It was the corporate events and some of that had to be postponed a little longer. That really didn't come back for a solid year and a half, 2 years probably.
So you just sunk all this money into this downtown wedding venue.
Yep.
And you're finally about to start reaping the benefit and the cash flow and some payback.
What's that?
And the world
global
shuts
pandemic.
Down. Yeah, what's that? Global pandemic. World shuts down. Obviously, an event space is not the place you want to be in. So what did you do? Yeah. I mean, at that point, you're just not getting a return on your investment, and you're probably, there's the holding cost of the asset and the utilities and the mortgage, so you're losing money still. So what kind of pivot did you guys have to make?
Yeah, it was literally a matter of continuing to make our mortgage payments or not, because we couldn't do events, and, it looked like it was going to be that way for the foreseeable future. And so restaurants could still open or be open after a period of time with limited capacity. We had like 6,500 square feet and we had an outdoor courtyard with a garage door. It was all enclosed. I mean, we had a fantastic space. And so
it's
like
done. It's ready to be it's like fully used.
We could spread people out. We can put people outside. We can do all kinds of things here. But the problem was we didn't have a commercial kitchen. We had no way to make food or anything. We had a bar there. But we had this ice cream shop a couple doors down, which my wife had just took over running because, long story short, this operating partner, he fizzled out, didn't want to be part of it. And so my wife, who is a teacher, took it over, and neither of us had any food service experience. So we're drinking from the fire hose, but she took it over the day that restaurants were closed to carry out only. And so we said, well, that business is struggling. The event business is non-existent. What if we try to mash them up and kind of create a pop-up restaurant concept that will run on like Fridays and Saturdays, and we'll do different live music. We'll do whatever kind of different events and pairings and this sort of thing as we can. And so that's what we did. So her and her staff would make food down at Topped, the ice cream sandwich shop. Then my kids, who were, I think, 7 and 9 at the time, they would be like the food runners. So they would take trays of food and they'd bring it down to the Brickyard, the event venue. And I'd be doing drinks at the bar and kind of setting up and tearing down. My partner, he would be doing sound and lights and different things. And I mean, we just figure it out a way to figure it out. And, we'd make $500 here, $1,000 there. And I mean, it would snowball to where we could. Kept being able to make that mortgage payment every month until we were able to shake loose enough to start having real events again.
Dude, that's crazy. I guarantee you, if my kids were running food back and forth, you'd get a pizza with like 3/4 of it. So your kids, they obviously were well suited for the job. Well, that's crazy. I mean, and I think why Seth and I are both excited for you to tell that story is just the grit, right? Like some people, I mean, just would have been faced with the same kind of cross in the road moment, but wouldn't have wanted to maybe work that hard or do something unknown like that, bring their family into it.
Or they would have given up, the government shut it down. It's out of my hands, whatever.
Yeah.
But we have to pivot. I mean, as entrepreneurs, as business owners, you got to be ready to pivot. You got to be ready to think creatively, in which you're obviously a creative thinker. So that that definitely benefited
necessity
you.
Necessity is the mother of invention.
That's true.
That's right.
That's awesome. Well, let's go into what we call our little nugget. So what is one practical takeaway, piece of advice that our listeners can implement to their real estate investing businesses?
I think that what I find myself telling people most often is just get out and do something. Mm. And I think that whether that's someone considering buying their first investment, it's someone that wants to find a mentor, it's someone that wants to find a partner, it's they want to fix up their downtown and they don't know what to do or where to start.
Right.
Just do something.
Do something.
Just get out there. And, you know, I joke that I get myself into these really sticky situations. And yes, but I think that when you just get in and you start something, you figure it out because you have to.
Yeah. Right.
And
yeah. Necessity.
So, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think that it shapes your creativity and your drive and your tenacity when you know that you're in it and you don't have it all figured out, but you've got to figure it out in order to keep things moving forward. Now, there's probably a line of recklessness,
negligence,
and aggressiveness, but right. I think that I'm always flirting with that line probably, and so I
is
just
this
encourage
the moment?
People
is this the
get
one?
Get out there and do it. Yeah,
yeah, that's good. Getting off first base is. And you start the learning process, you know, you start getting reps in about who you are as a leader, what you're interested in, the mechanics of business and the nuances of that. So that's true. The times I grow the most are when I throw myself into a situation. And then like my wife, she's really good about forethought. So like she already knows kind of how it's going to play out before it happens. And so sometimes that keeps her from entering into a situation. I was like, let's do it. Looks like a good opportunity to me. And then we get in it. I'm like, if I could do this again, I don't think I'd do it. But I'm here. So we're going to make the best of it. That's funny. Good advice. So what's been one of the best resources for you? Just as in development, in business, in leadership, best resource?
I'm a constant learner. And I think that in order to do things, you've got to be constantly learning. So I heard this quote many years ago. I've shared it with a lot of people that in 5 years, you'll be the same person you are today, except for the people you meet and the books you read.
Mm.
And so I guess maybe it's not a singular resource, but it's getting out, meeting people, not in a like networky, any
forced.
Kind of like forced way. But just to meet people, just to get to know people. And it's amazing the way that connections compound and someone can make a connection for you. And it's just enjoyable, right? To meet other people, hear their stories. Yeah. Obviously that's why you're doing this podcast.
So, right.
And then, just reading, constantly consuming content and whether it's podcasts, YouTube videos, I listen to a ton of audiobooks. I read regular books too, but I'm always on the go, so I find it easier to do audiobooks. But just to always be in that mode of learning, I think, is never going to steer you wrong.
What's been one of your favorite audiobooks that you've been listening to just in the last couple of months?
Dude, I am loving Alex Hormozi's $100 Million Offers.
Huh.
If you've heard that at all.
No.
But it is just like a masterclass on like creating offers, finding, so there's two books in the series. There's ultimately going to be four. So there's $100 million offers. And then there's $100 million leads. If you could only buy or only listen to one or read one, I'd say $100 million leads. I'm like 3/4 of the way through it. I just literally bought like half a dozen copies. I'm going to
take
to some people and especially like in my businesses, our marketing and sales teams, just because there is so much gold in there. I really super highly recommend it.
Wow. Sweet. We'll look into that. As always, we'll put that in the show notes. How can people find out more about your success? Kind of follow what you guys are doing. What's the best way to do that?
Welcome to follow along on social media. We are good-ish. I'm trying to improve on keeping things fresh there. So Henry Development Group on Facebook, Main Street Reimagined on Facebook. You're welcome to connect with me personally, Facebook, LinkedIn, just Luke Henry. And yeah, I love talking shop, learning from other investors, developers, entrepreneurs. I think that there's a lot of inspiration to be found in finding our tribe and just encouraging others, because it can be a lonely journey.
Yeah.
And knowing that others are fighting some of the same battles keeps us going on those tough days.
Yeah, that's good, man. So last question. If somebody's in Marion, Ohio, where should they go to eat? Or what would be a notable stop?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would encourage you to find South Main Street and check out some of our projects there. There's the Brickyard on Main, Topped Ice Cream and Eatery, Style 124, Salon Suites, Lulu's Toy Co. There's some great boutique retail, Maddie's on Main and Spruce and Sparrow. Mm. And then Bucci's Italian Scratch Kitchen. That's a concept that we just created earlier this year. It's in an old like trolley station, railway station, and there's also a wedding venue there called Urban 501. And so just some cool spaces that we've been part of reimagining, and more on the way. And if somebody is around, I mean, hit me up. I'm always giving tours and would be happy to connect.
Awesome, man.
Awesome.
Well, dude, thank you for coming on today.
Thank you.
As always, excited that you joined us on another episode of the Reinvest Podcast. If this episode added to your tool belt or left you feeling inspired, go ahead and share it with a friend. Stay tuned every Tuesday for new episodes. And if you want to get in touch with us, go to our LinkedIn or Facebook profiles and shoot us a message. Move farther, reach higher, and grow deeper. See you next time.